was at the National Press Club here in Washington, D.C. yesterday. The event, including a question and answer session, lasts about an hour.
Folks, we're about to begin. Good afternoon and welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Larry Lippman. I'm the president of the National Press Club and Washington bureau chief for the Palm Beach Post and the Cox Newspapers Bureau. I would like to welcome club members and their guests in the audience today, as well as those of you watching on C-SPAN or listening to this program on National Public Radio. Before introducing our head table, I would like to remind our members of some upcoming speakers. On Monday, May 17th, General Colin Powell will be here to discuss America's promise. On Tuesday, May 18th, author Tom Clancy and General Chuck Horner will be our speakers. And on Thursday, May 20th, Senator John McCain will be speaking. National Press Club members may access transcripts and audio files of our luncheons at our website, npc.press.org. Non-members may purchase audio and video tapes by calling 1-888-343-1940. If you have any questions for our speaker, please write them on the cards provided at your table and pass them up to me, and I will attempt to ask as many as possible. I already have to let you know I have plenty so far. I would like to introduce our head table guests now and ask them to please stand briefly when their names are called. Please hold your applause until all of the head table guests are introduced. All of the journalists at the head table are club members. From your right, Bob Westgate, freelance journalist. Bill Gibson, bureau chief of the Fort Lauderdale Sun-Sentinel. John Orovec, AFL-CIO News. Mark Russell, comedian and entertainer. Scott Shepard, Cox Newspapers. Ken Eske, chairman of the Speakers Committee. Skipping our speaker for a moment, Gordon Smith, president of the Gordon L. Smith Company and the member who arranged today's luncheon. Richard Salmon, associate editor, Congressional Quarterly, and former National Press Club president. Bob Orban, freelance comedy writer. Marshall Cohen, freelance photojournalist. And John Mulligan, bureau chief of the Providence Journal. With George Carlin as our speaker and Mark Russell as a head table guest, the last thing that I should do today is try to be funny. So I won't try, and I suspect I will succeed admirably. George Carlin should have been a reporter. After all, he asked such great questions. One that has stuck with me for more than 30 years is, how come there's no blue food? That's the only one that I'll steal. Like any good journalist, he's a first-rate wordsmith, and I'm sure he will demonstrate his ability to dissect words and phrases, exposing their true meaning and hilarity here today. And he'd make a heck of an editorial writer. Ask him about violence and slavery and the fate of the American Indians. But instead of being a journalist, George Carlin became a comedian. He's been at it now for four decades. Along the way, he's recorded 18 comedy albums and picked up two Grammy Awards, made several hundred television appearances, including 135 times with Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show, was featured in 9 movies, got his star on Hollywood's Walk of Fame, and has done 11 one-man HBO specials. No one else is even close. His most recent book, Brain Droppings, has sold more than 600,000 copies, either in hardback or paperback, and been on the New York Times bestseller list for 38 weeks. His comedy is legendary. He's been called the thinking man's comedian, a sarcastic semantist, and a protean talent. Of course, Mr. Carlin was the composer of the famous list of 7 words you can never say on television, none of which he will use today, which resulted in the United States Supreme Court rendering a ruling on the use of such words as, and well, you know. George Carlin began his career as a suit-wearing, clean-cut comedian. He came in with the Beat Generation, took off with the folk artists, and cruised with the hippies. He gained fame as the hippy-dippy weatherman and soared as a counterculture iconoclast. Now, Carlin's career is exploding once again. And there's a new generation of Americans who know George Carlin in a way that none of us ever imagined when we listened to his comedy. For my daughter and the nearly decade worth of preschoolers who grew up watching Shining Time Station on PBS, George Carlin is Mr. Conductor, the tiny man who knows more Thomas the Tank Engine stories than anyone else. Ladies and gentlemen, let's have a warm National Press Club welcome for Mr. George Carlin.
Thank you. Thank you all. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you for the fine introduction, Larry, and thank you for the members of the head table. Thanks for those of you who accepted the invitation to come here today or volunteered, and thanks for the invitation in general. I can assure you I am properly nervous, not because of simply my esteemed audience, but because this is a setting I'm not completely familiar with, and as we all know, anything new is to be feared and dreaded. And just to relieve you of any outstanding anxieties, I can assure you that I'm not here to advance any political, social, or environmental cause. I am, in fact, blessedly agenda-free. I don't want to save the river, I don't want to save the bay, I don't want to save the canyon, the whale, the wetlands, the rainforest, or the flying spotted dwarf something or other. I don't want to save the children above all, frankly. Frankly, I don't care about many of those things, and between you and me, those battles were lost a long time ago. I'm not interested in freeing someone, boycotting something, or preventing anything. I am interested in keeping my lunch inside my mouth if I can. And I don't want to make something optional. I refuse to wear ribbons of any color. You might say I'm just here to help define deviancy down. To be honest, there aren't many things I do believe in, but high among them would be friendship, family ties, and romantic love. I think those things can take you a long way. For the record, the only worthy cause I have devoted time to is a little-known place that does wonderful work, St. Anthony's Home for the Visually Unpleasant. It's run by the Little Sisters of the Heinous, and in fact, they operate a number of facilities, the Rochester Home for the Permanently Disheveled, the New England Haven for the Occasionally Coherent, and the Catholic Shelter for those who up until a year ago seemed to be doing just fine. Now, one of the things I wanted to do before I got too far along was to tell you a little more about myself in order to establish some common ground, create perhaps a more permissive environment. And so, with this in mind, and in the spirit of full disclosure, I would like to reveal to you my own remarkably tenuous connections to the press. More accurately, those of my family, and you can relax, none of these connections falls within the editorial area. So, here we go. In the 1930s and 1940s, my father sold newspaper advertising space and was consistently one of the top two or three space salesmen in the country by actual lineage count. He began at the old Philadelphia American, moved to the Bulletin, and ended his career as the national advertising manager of the New York Sun. He also put in some time at the New York Post when it was still a broadsheet, or as my mother used to say, when it was a real newspaper, not a commie rag. As many of you no doubt know, long before the New York Post was a fascist rag, it was a commie rag. Prior to that, it had been an establishment rag. That's when my dad was there. My mother, manager of the Philadelphia Bulletin's New York office, and later worked in the magazine division of the Hearst Corporation, first at Good Housekeeping and then at Cosmopolitan, once again when it was a real magazine. Now, there is one more member of my family whose press connections I must tell you about, and this is the good one, my Aunt Aggie. This is the connection that gave me standing in the neighborhood, made me a big man on the playground. My Aunt Aggie also worked for the Hearst Corporation, but she worked for Puck the Comic Weekly, the publication that produced the Sunday Funnies every week. Like I said, tenuous stuff. But here's the great thing about Aggie's job. Not only did she bring home the funnies every week, she brought them home 4 weeks early. Are you hearing this? Every week, I had the Sunday Funnies a month before the other kids. And I guess you can realize the power this gave me in the schoolyard. To be able to predict weeks ahead of time precisely the way Mandrake the magician would escape from the lost cave, or to describe in advance the details of whatever well-deserved catastrophe was next in store for little orphan Annie. Doesn't sound like much today, but in the days before television, and when you're 8 years old, it was power beyond belief. Of course, you had to be careful not to overdo the predictions, and you could never, ever tell the other kids about the great job your Aunt Aggie had. Now, having somewhat successfully established my press credentials, and because you and I have at least one thing in common, which is that all of us deal with language all the time, I thought it might be nice today for me to come to you with some of my language complaints. Certainly not to blame them on you, although, of course, you are implicated. And not that you can help it. I mean, the problem is really with the people you cover, the politicians, the celebrities, and the lawyers. And although their level of insincerity is astonishing, it's still kind of fun to hear them talk. In particular, it's fun to listen to Washington talk. Whenever the issue of term limits comes up, I always tell people the only term limits I'm interested in would be to limit some of the terms used by politicians. They speak, of course, with great caution, because they must take care not to actually say anything. Proof of this, according to their own words, is that they don't actually say things, they indicate them. As I indicated yesterday, and as the president indicated to me, but sometimes they don't indicate, they suggest. Let me suggest that as I indicated yesterday, I haven't determined that yet. See, they don't decide, they determine. If it's a really serious matter, they make a judgment. I haven't made a judgment on that yet. When the hearings are concluded, I will make a judgment, or I might make an assessment. I'm not sure. I haven't determined that yet. But when I do, I will advise you. They don't tell, they advise. I advised him that I had made a judgment. Thus far, he hasn't responded. They don't answer, they respond. He hasn't responded to my initiative. An initiative is an idea that isn't going anywhere. When he responds to my initiative, I will review his response, take a position, and make a recommendation. See, they don't read, they review. They don't have opinions, they take positions. And they don't give advice, they make recommendations. And so, at long last, after each has responded to the other's initiatives, and each has reviewed the other's responses, and everyone has taken a position, made a judgment, and offered a recommendation, now they have to do something. But that would be much too direct. So instead, they address the problem. We're addressing the problem, and we'll soon be proceeding. That's a big activity here in Washington. Proceeding. They're always proceeding or moving forward. A lot of that goes on. Senator, have you solved that problem? Well, we're moving forward on that. And when they're not moving forward, they're moving something else forward, such as the process. We have to move the process forward so we can implement the provisions of the initiative in order to meet these challenges. No one has problems anymore. Challenges. That's why we need people who can make the tough decisions. Tough decisions like, how much soft money can I expect to collect in exchange for my core values? So that... so that I can continue my work in government. Of course, no politician would admit to such a lowly station as working in government, serving the nation. I'm serving the nation. Another favorite distortion is public service. I'm in public service. I like America, don't you? The food is great, but the public service is terrible. Now, folks, a question for you. Do you think it's possible that one of these politicians, whose judgment is so poor that he honestly thinks of himself as serving the nation, might occasionally be expected to indulge in a little patriotism? Huh? What do you think? Well, of course, not only is it possible, it's inevitable, and that's when he's at his very best. That's when he trots out the really good stuff all across this great land of ours. The greatest nation on earth, the greatest nation in the history of the world. And in times of military crisis, you can be sure that someone in a suit in this town will eventually plant himself in front of a camera and carry on a great deal about the most powerful nation on the face of the earth. Now, normally, during peacetime, the politicians will refer to people in the military as our young men and women stationed around the world. But in wartime, they quickly become our brave young fighting men and women stationed halfway around the world in places whose names they can't pronounce, wondering if they'll ever see their loved ones again. For added emotional impact, sons and daughters can always be substituted for men and women. And so I think we can sum this up by saying that where the military is concerned, the extent of a politician's insincerity can be measured by how far around the world our soldiers are stationed and whether or not any of them can pronounce it. Incidentally, another way of expressing this sentiment is to say we're sending our young men and women to places the average American can't find on a map. I've always thought it was kind of funny and somewhat out of character for a politician to go out of his way to point out the low level of American intelligence when indeed his very job depends upon it. It would seem to fly in the face of that other rhetorical standby of theirs, the American people are a lot smarter than they're given credit for. This is said with a straight face, although it is obvious, of course, that the proposition is being stated precisely backwards. But the politicians, God bless them, or something like that, they're at their most entertaining when they're in trouble. When they're in trouble, their explanations usually begin simply with words like miscommunication. What did you do wrong, Senator? Well, it was a miscommunication. Or I was quoted out of context. Better yet, and more ironic, they twisted my words. Such a nice touch. A person who routinely spends his days torturing the language complains, they twisted my words. Then, as the controversy continues to heat up, he moves to his next level of complaint. The whole thing has been blown out of proportion. It's always the whole thing. Apparently, no one has ever claimed that only a small portion of something was blown out of proportion. Has to be the whole thing. That's because now he's feeling the heat. And so, as time passes and more evidence comes in, he suddenly changes directions and tells us, we're trying to get to the bottom of this. Now he's on the side of law and order. It's jiu-jitsu, really. We're trying to get to the bottom of this so we can get the facts out to the American people. That's always a nice touch, American people. In fact, at this point, he might even say, I'm willing to trust in the fairness of the American people. Clearly, he's preparing us for something. And so, when finally all the facts come out and our subject seems quite guilty, he employs that sublime use of the passive voice, mistakes were made. Mistakes were made, don't look at me. Probably someone in my office. Things are moving faster now. Mistakes were made is rapidly overtaken by there is no evidence. No one has proven anything. Eventually, I will be exonerated. I have faith in the American judicial system. And that certain sign that things are closing in, whatever happened to innocent until proven guilty? Whatever happened? Well, nah, yeah. Well, he's about to find out. And we know this must be true because the next thing we hear from him is, I just want to put this thing behind me and get on with my life. I just want to put this behind me. That's an expression we hear a lot these days in all walks of life. From people in all walks of life, usually the person in question has committed some unspeakable act. Yes, it's true, I strangled my wife, shot the triplets, set fire to the house, and sold my young son to an old man on the train. But now I just want to put this thing behind me. Get on with it. That's the problem in this country. Too many people getting on with their lives. I think what we really need more of is ritual suicide. You know? Never mind the press conferences. Get the big knife out of the drawer. Personally, what I want to do is to put this, I want to put this thing behind me and get on with my life, thing behind me and get on with my life. I'll repeat that for you. Personally, I want to put this thing behind me and get on with my life, thing behind me and get on with my life. And just to round out this section, let's hope there's a special place in hell reserved for those who have recently decided to take responsibility for their actions. That's the big thing now, taking responsibility for your actions, like it's a recent discovery, you know. He's taking responsibility for his actions. Well, isn't that wonderful? Ask him if he's willing to take responsibility for my actions. along with my alimony, my car payments, and my gambling debts. Now, continuing with more of these more general language complaints, and forgetting the Washington angle for the moment, I'd like to mention America's love affair with euphemisms and euphemistic language. I think Americans have some difficulty dealing with reality and have invented a kind of soft language to protect themselves. And this tendency to euphemize, if that's a verb, increases, it seems, with every generation. Here's an example. There's a well-known condition in combat when a fighting man's nervous system has been stressed to the breaking point and he's either snapped or is ready to snap. In the First World War, that condition was known as shell shock. Simple, honest, direct language, two syllables, shell shock. Almost sounds like the guns themselves. That was over 80 years ago. Then an entire generation passed, and in the Second World War, the very same combat condition was called battle fatigue. Four syllables now, takes a little longer to say, doesn't seem to hurt as much. Fatigue is a nicer word than shock. Shell shock. Battle fatigue. Then we had Korea, 1950. Madison Avenue was riding high, and the very same combat condition was called operational exhaustion. We're up to eight syllables now, and the humanity has been squeezed completely out of the phrase. It's absolutely sterile, operational exhaustion. Sounds like something that might happen to your car. Finally, of course, there was Vietnam, and given the lies surrounding that war, I guess it's no surprise that the very same condition was called post-traumatic stress disorder. Still eight syllables, but we've added a hyphen, and the pain is now completely buried under jargon, post-traumatic stress disorder. I'd be willing to bet that if we'd still been calling it shell shock, some of those Vietnam veterans might have gotten the attention they needed at the time they needed it. But it didn't happen. And one of the reasons, I'm sure, is because of that soft language, the language that takes the life out of life. And it does keep getting worse over time. I'll give you a few more, but less dramatic examples. Sometime during my life, toilet paper became bathroom tissue. I was not consulted on this. It just happened. Sneakers became running shoes, loafers became slip-ons, motels became motor lodges, trailers became mobile homes, truck stops became travel plazas, and used cars became previously owned transportation. Manicurists evolved into nail technicians. At about the same time, store clerks became product specialists and sales associates. Employees became staff, uniforms became career apparel. Maids became room attendants, and room service became guest room dining. Information turned into directory assistance. Medicine turned into medication. The dump turned into the landfill. Gambling joints turned into gaming resorts. Shacking up, living together, reruns, encores. Encore presentations, forgive me. Monkey bars, pipe frame exercise units. Wife beating became intermittent explosive disorder, and constipation became occasional irregularity. Rainforests and wetlands came into existence because the environmentalists discovered people were not willing to give money to save jungles and swamps. And now, all of this happened in the last 30 years. When I was a young man, if someone got sick, they went to the hospital or they went to the doctor. Now, the health maintenance organization sends them to a wellness center where they consult a healthcare delivery professional. Poor people used to live in slums. Now, the economically disadvantaged occupy substandard housing in the inner cities. And we can't really discuss euphemisms if we don't mention that final taboo, death. Used to be that when an old person died, the undertaker put him in a coffin, and we sent flowers to the funeral home where they held a wake. Then after the funeral, they drove the dead person in a hearse to the cemetery, and his body was buried in a grave. Now, when a senior citizen passes away, the mortician places him in a burial container, and we send floral tributes to the slumber room, where the grief coordinator supervises the viewing. After the memorial service, the funeral coach transports the departed to the Garden of Remembrance, where his remains are interred in his final resting place. Some of this language can make you want to throw up. Well, perhaps engage in an involuntary protein spill. Yeah. Now, Now, if all of this begins to put you in mind of so-called politically correct language or politically correct speech, excuse me, then you and I are on the same track. So let's visit that playground of guilty white liberals, the land of the politically correct. In recent years, the PC folks have found some new ways of shading the truth in order to make people feel better, especially minorities. One of the newer phrases making the rounds is happens to be. He happens to be black. I have a friend who happens to be black.
Oh, I see, yes, yes.
Like it's an accident, you know. Happens to be black. Yes, he happens to be black.
I see, I see, I see.
He had two black parents? Yes, that's right, two black parents. Yes.
I see. And they had sex?
Oh, indeed they did.
Yeah, I see.
So where does the surprise part come in? I should think it would be more unusual if he just happened to be Scandinavian. Another favorite term, recently favorite term, is openly. Openly gay. I have a friend who's openly gay. But that's the only minority they use that for. You know, you wouldn't say someone was openly black. Well, maybe James Brown. Yes. James Brown, yes. Or Louis Farrakhan. Louis Farrakhan is openly black. Colin Powell is not openly black. Colin Powell is openly white. He just happens to be black. And while we're at it, when did the word urban become synonymous with the word black? Did I sleep through this, perhaps? Urban styles, urban trends, urban music. I was not consulted on this at all again. Didn't get an email, didn't get a fax, didn't get a postcard. That's fine, let them go. So I would like to tell you how I handle some of these speech issues concerning minorities. First of all, I say black. I say black because most black people prefer black. I don't say people of color because it's dishonest. It means precisely the same thing as colored people, which is an insult. So if you're not willing to say colored people, you shouldn't be willing to say people of color. And besides, to me, the whole idea of color seems a bit specious, really. I mean, what should we call white people? People of no color? Isn't pink a color? And in fact, white people are not really white at all. They're different shades of pink and olive and beige. In other words, they're colored. And black people are rarely black. I see mostly various shades of brown and tan, and in fact, some light-skinned black people are darker than the darkest white people. I'm sorry, lighter than the darkest white people. Look how dark the people in India are. They're dark brown, but they're considered white. May I see the color chart, please? People of color is an awkward phrase that obscures meaning rather than enhancing it. What shall we call fat people? People of size? I also don't say African Americans. I find it cumbersome and confusing. Which part of Africa are we talking about? Egypt? Egypt is in Africa, but Egyptians aren't black. They're like the people in India. They're dark brown white people. But they're Africans. So why wouldn't an Egyptian citizen who becomes an Egyptian who becomes a U.S. citizen be called an African American? The same would apply to South Africa. Suppose a white racist from South Africa becomes an American citizen. Couldn't he call himself an African American? If for no other reason than just to bother black people. And what about a black person born in South Africa who becomes an American citizen? Is he an African American or is he a South African American? Or is he simply a South African American African American? You know, it's just so much more tedious liberal labeling. Liberals should be taught that labels divide people, and I think we could probably do with fewer labels, not more. Now, one more group, the Indians. I call them Indians because that's what they are. They're the Indians. There's nothing wrong with the word. First of all, it's important to know that Indian, that word, probably does not derive from Columbus believing he had reached India in 1492. India was called Hindustan. More likely, the word derives from Columbus's description of the people he found here. He was an Italian who spoke very poor Spanish, and in his written accounts, he called the Indians una gente in Dios, a people in God. In God, in Dios, Indians. It's a perfectly noble thing. And I simply can't justify this awkward phrase, Native Americans. First of all, they're not natives. They came here from Asia over the Bering Land Bridge. In fact, there are no natives anywhere in the world. Everyone is from somewhere else. All people are refugees, immigrants, or aliens. If there are natives anywhere, it would have to be people still living in the Great Rift Valley in Africa. So everyone is just visiting. So much for native. As far as calling them Americans is concerned, well, how can I say this? We steal their hemisphere, destroy 500 cultures, kill 20 million, stick the rest of them on the worst land we can find, and then as a special bonus, we name them after ourselves. It's embarrassing. It's just embarrassing. The truth is, most Indians are insulted by the term Native American. The American Indian movement will tell you that. If you wish to please Indians, try calling them by their traditional names, Pawnee, Mohawk, Navajo, Seminole, and so on. Now, just rounding out this theme and to make you a little more uncomfortable, here are a few further examples of tortured modern language designed to soften reality, make people feel good, and in general, dress things up a little. Somewhere over the years, the word cripple has been lost. We don't have cripples anymore. Turns out we never did. All this time, they were physically challenged. It's an attempt to make people feel better. Physically challenged. And how's this one? Differently abled. Now, if you insist on using differently abled, then you must include all of us. We're all differently abled. Each of us can do things the other can't. Differently abled. The word crippled is not a dishonorable word. There's no shame in it. Jesus healed the cripples. He didn't engage in rehabilitative strategies for the physically disadvantaged. And we have then this continuing problem with the word fat. I use that term because that's what fat people are. They're fat. That's why we call them fat people. They're not large. They're not stout. They're not chunky, hefty, or plump. And they're not big-boned. Dinosaurs are big-boned. And they're not necessarily obese. Obese is a medical term. And they're not overweight. Overweight implies there is some correct weight. There is no correct weight. Heavy is also a misleading term. An aircraft carrier is heavy. It's not fat. Only people are fat, and that's what fat people are. They're fat. They're not exempt. They're not, for example, gravitationally disadvantaged. I offer no apology for this, by the way. It's not intended as criticism or insult. It's simply descriptive language. I'm not comfortable with euphemisms. I prefer seeing things the way they are, not the way some people wish they were. Midgets and dwarfs are midgets and dwarfs. They're not little people. Infants are little people. Leprechauns are little people. Midgets and dwarfs are midgets and dwarfs. They don't get any taller by calling them little people. I wish their lives were different. I wish they didn't have to walk around staring at crotches all day. But I cannot fix that, and I'm not going to lie about what they are. There are some people who playfully refer to them as vertically challenged. They're not vertically challenged. The flying Walendas were vertically challenged. The people who built the Empire State Building were vertically challenged. No shame in midgets and dwarves. I do have a closing. I realize my time is a little longer than I expected. May I do this closing poem? This, thank you, Larry. This is Try Stopping Me. Now... Thank you. This is just a poem I've written recently. It's called I'm a Man for the Millennium, and it tries to celebrate some of the language we hear all around us. I'm going to use my papers on this, although it'd be good if you kept rolling for me anyway. I'm a man for the millennium. I'm digital and smoke-free. I've been outputted in... I've been up... Start again, George. You can edit this. I'm a man for the millennium, digital and smoke-free. I've been inputted, outsourced, uplinked, and downloaded. I have software on my hard drive, and I can give you a gigabyte in a nanosecond. I'm factory authorized, returnable, fully equipped, built to last, and I'm definitely biodegradable. My output is down, but my income is up. I'm tanned, rested, and market-tested, user-friendly, and lactose intolerant. A diversified, multicultural, postmodern deconstructionist. I'm a cutting-edge, state-of-the-art, high-concept rageaholic, and I have a love child who sends me hate mail. I'm an alpha male on beta blockers, a bottom feeder and a top gun, a Bigfoot rainmaker. I give soft money with hard cash, and my revenue stream has a cash flow of its own. I'm ahead of the curve, riding the wave and pushing the envelope. I'm on board, on point, on message, but off drugs. I take power naps. I take victory laps. I've got a personal trainer, a personal shopper, and a personal agenda. I'm a totally ongoing slam dunk no-brainer with an outreach that's proactive. I eat junk food, I get junk mail, I buy junk bonds, I watch trash sports. I've been dumbed down with smart bombs. I'm in denial, I'm in recovery, but I'm out of the loop. I'm also on the bubble. A high-tech lowlife, anatomically, ecologically, and politically incorrect. An entry-level man with no exit strategy. Low rent, but high maintenance. Upscale, but down home. I got a minivan with a microwave from a megastore in the mini mall. I've been to outer space. I've been to outer space on the internet. I'm a non-believer and an overachiever, emotionally deprived and market-oriented. I have hardcore software because I use the F word in my email. I'm new wave from the old school, and if I'm not at ground zero, you can reach me at square one. I'm gender-specific, voice-activated, capital-intensive, heat-seeking, faith-based, and work-related, but I'm definitely not group-oriented. I'm online, I'm in line, but most of the time, I'm out of line. I'm cocked, locked, and ready to rock, rough, tough, and hard to bluff. I put the pedal to the metal, party hardy, and to me, lunchtime is crunch time. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it.
That was amazing.
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you. We're going to get right into the questions because we have a whole lot of them. We're going to get right into the questions because we have a ton of them, and I want to get to as many as possible. I have about this many questions about seven words and about this many questions about everything else. So we'll start with some of the seven word questions. Are there really seven dirty words anymore that are unacceptable since so many of the original list are now commonplace in the media? And what would you say are Tipper Gore's seven dirty words?
I'll choose the first part of that question to answer. Those seven words of mine are still, that still holds up pretty well. They're pretty hardcore. One of them, the one that begins with the letter P and is four letters long, is usable now depending if you use the preposition off after it. It's all right. It's all right to be pissed off. They say that all the time. Just don't use it with the preposition on following it. And I would imagine, sorry. I would imagine Tipper Gore's seven dirty words. Well, they might number more than my own. There might be seven to the seventh power. I really don't know. Sorry.
Would you comment in seven words or so on the Internet Communications Decency Act?
Yeah, here we go again. The original case that I was involved in, only peripherally, really, it wasn't my case. It was the FCC versus Pacifica Broadcasting. That was when this word indecency, as far as I know, first came into the legal lexicon. Prior to that, it was a problem of something being obscene or not obscene, and then they found indecent, another little area to restrict strictly for broadcast. I think the internet might be powerful enough and have qualities to it that are sufficiently vast and elusive that they'll never really pin it down. I don't think they'll pin it down too well. There's some talk of this. I'm not very well informed on the Indecency Act. I'm just recently a person who has only begun to look at the internet, so I don't follow things very avidly in that sector of our culture. But so I apologize for not really having much more of an opinion, except here we go again, indecency.
As a wordsmith and the author of Seven Dirty Words, do you feel that losing restrictions on speech has cheapened our cultural discourse?
No, I don't know that I could say that. I think euphemisms are probably, euphemistic language is more harmful. There will always be language taboos in any culture. There are aspects of our bodies that certain religions have sort of put beyond the pale, and those parts of the body that deal with those functions will always be somewhat, I think, a little bit of this, if not outright banned. I don't think cheapened our discourse. I think it limits people. I always said I enjoy using all the language. Human beings invented all of this language. And when I was a little boy, I was told to look up to policemen and look up to sports stars and to look up to the military. And we all know how they speak. We all know the language they use. And apparently, it hasn't corrupted them morally. So I think these words are overrated for their power.
After Boston columnist, Mike Barnicle used the a dozen lines from Brain Droppings without attribution, some of the media passed it off as, well, they were just jokes. What is your response to that? And has Mike ever cried on your shoulder about his what he did? And what do you make of it all?
Well, I was not too upset by the whole thing. I think if a comedian had stolen my stuff, it would have felt different to me. I told him immediately, by the way, that that I wasn't going to get in on this. I just kind of sat back and sent him a book, in fact, and signed it, Now You Can Eliminate the Middleman. So, yeah. But what he did, whoever did it, whether it was a source, someone that he uses to feed him items or not, someone changed each of the jokes just enough, they thought, to disguise them. That part didn't work. And what they did was make them all worse. I had spent months, you know how editing and revising your own stuff is. You really go over and over and you look and you just try it a couple of ways and you keep going back to the one you had yesterday. And I took a lot of time on those sentences and they made them all worse. As an example, one of them was just an observation where I said, someday I'd like to see the Pope come out on that balcony and give the football scores. And they changed it to baseball, which is not as funny. For whatever reason, Mark will know better than I, perhaps, football is funnier than baseball in that sentence. By the way, at the time of this event, when this thing took place about Barnacle, my book had slipped down. It was in its last weeks on the New York Times list, and it had slipped to number 11, and Mike Barnacle bumped it up to number 7. It stayed at number 7 and 8 and 9 for quite a while, so I thank him for the extra weeks.
You mentioned the military. We have several questions on Kosovo. Let me ask them all together and see what you can come up with. Is what we're doing in Kosovo a war or something else? What advice would you give President Clinton for solving the Kosovo problem? And what's your reaction to a draft-dodging president leading our UN forces in Kosovo, especially pictures of him shaking hands with the troops?
Hmm. Well, first I must tell you that I take most public events and things that occur that I read avidly, I take them rather not seriously. It is nice to see that we're up to that humanitarian bombing again. I used to complain that all we ever bombed were brown people. And now I've had to revise that. Although I would imagine that we've justified the Serbians as being far enough east from Western Europe to classify as some semi-brown group. I really don't have much of an opinion on this. I see this culture as circling the drain in ever faster and tighter circles, and I just observe it and enjoy observing. I root for that demise of this culture. I root for the demise of this species. It just happens to be my hobby to kind of root for all this stuff to go away and give another species a chance, perhaps. I root for the big comet. I root for the big asteroid. I honestly do. And I did that before those movies came out. I honestly do. I think we've had a turn. Let someone else have it. It's all it is now is the search for dollars and the search for the things that dollars buy, and there's very little of a core humanity left. It happens. It works on the individual level and on the small scale. On the large scale, it's all a human comedy. It's all a joke, and I try to treat it as that. I don't do much political. I don't do current events in any of my shows. I just don't. I think it's trivia. So I kind of roll along and root for everything to go away.
Speaking of jokes, do you have subjects that are taboo and are therefore not joke material? For example, John Cleese has commented that he would never joke about cancer.
Well, my belief is that in the proper context, if the humorist or the writer or comedian prepares the context sufficiently for the audience, they will go with him into it. Depending on, you can say the most horrendous of things as long as they're just not said cold, as long as you prepare people and bring them along. I don't have any subjects like that. I think these recent shootings in Littleton, I was very proud of myself because I had an existing piece about this need to send all of these psychologists in after all of these school shootings. The first thing we hear is that the psychologists and psychiatrists and grief counselors and trauma therapists have rushed in to help the children cope. And I made the observation that we're told also in the same breath that these children are killing each other because they're desensitized to violence. They've been desensitized. Well, if they're desensitized, what do they need all this counseling for? And I was just very happy to make that observation on the night of the shooting and the next night because I enjoy having the audience a little bit on edge. And so I have no taboos. I joke about things that I care about, so I usually prepare them in a context where they're acceptable to folks who aren't expecting them.
How difficult was it for you to switch to a children's program, the Shining Time Station? Who was the better Mr. Conductor, you or Ringo Starr? And who was the better drummer?
The drummer part is easy, of course. I took that as an acting job. I thought it was a way to show a side of me that perhaps wasn't evident and that people might be interested in. And it was a good acting job. They do very good work, as any of you have seen it know. The production values are very high. And Ringo Starr, well, replacing Ringo makes me the anti-Pete Best. You have to know that.
We cigar smokers were deeply offended by your remarks about us on HBO. Will you now apologize?
I once criticized Don Rickles for apologizing at the end of his act by saying, well, I didn't really mean any of that. No, I wouldn't apologize. I think it's nice that smokers are being, not cigar smokers in particular, but that smokers in general will be given these little pens, these little glass rooms in airports. It's really interesting to look at the body language. Smokers outside of a building during working hours, very interesting to watch. It's a furtive look. It's a kind of shame. There's a sort of petty criminal kind of body behavior. And what I always do is I meet people individually whom I've castigated as a group. I always just tell them, well, I'll give you special dispensation, because I honestly love and enjoy people one by one. And I see the universe in their eyes. When I look at each person, I can see something that I've never seen before. It's when they begin to clot into groups that I begin to take offense. So that was for cigar smokers in general, not one by one.
You've had some experience with substance abuse, but sober now. What advice would you give policymakers in this regard?
Well, I'm one of those who feels that taking the premium out of narcotics and various other drugs that are illegal would, if there were no profit in it, I think some of that problem would disappear. And I think nature has a way of weeding out those who are kind of not going to make it ultimately. And I think it should be up to each individual whether or not he's going to make it ultimately. My own quitting drugs, and I was a cocaine freak. That was my weakness. At that time, I saw it as a strength, I guess. The way I quit was just to stop. I didn't go to a program. I didn't join a thing with steps in it or anything. I was lucky in that respect that I was able to just cut down my use slowly. Same with alcohol. Just cut it down slowly, less and less, less frequently and less frequently, and for shorter and shorter durations until one day. Just cut it down slowly, less and less, less frequently and less frequently, and for shorter and shorter durations until one day it just wasn't there at all. I have a feeling that there's too much reliance on people holding hands and wishing for things. I think you have to kind of look and see the relationship of pain to pleasure. These things are always pleasurable when you begin to do them. And as the time goes on, the ratio of pain to pleasure changes, and pretty soon it's mostly pain and very little pleasure left in it. And that's when the intellect should take over and say, you know, this is kind of stupid. And it's costing an awful lot. That's what happened to me. And I have no prescription. Public policy is not my area. I'd say perhaps legalizing these things would help the Darwinian side of things sort us all out.
Why aren't comedians funny anymore? Where are the future? You didn't let me finish this.
The question.
Where are the future George Carlins or Henny Youngmans hiding?
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's the questions that make us less than funny. No. This is an odd thing. This is a career that is not chosen for itself. Most people choose to get into comedy especially to get their sitcom or to set themselves up for another step, the sitcom or the movies or whatever. I came into it hoping to be an actor and hoping to be perhaps something like a Danny Kaye or a Jack Lemmon, and I found I couldn't act at all and was forced to remain on the road and figure my life out. And as I remained on the road, I got better and better at what I did. I found that it was an honest craft, and in fact, that art was involved. It's, well, art was a friend for many years, so why not? But I, without sounding pretentious, I do like to point out that there is an artistic process involved with observing the world, interpreting it, and then writing something about it and performing it. It's the low end of the scale, perhaps, in art. It's not fine art, but it is art, and I found that out, and it gave me a purpose, and it gave me some strength, and I stayed with my comedy because I found out I was much better at it than I ever expected. I do a little acting, but I love writing comedy and delivering it, so I don't know where the new ones are because they don't choose to do this for a lifetime beforehand. It either happens that way or not. And I'm happy it happened that way to me.
Speaking about future comedians, what should Al Gore do to lighten up?
Well, I'll tell you. I have only one observation about Al Gore. I think he will never be president because he pronounces the indefinite article as A. He says, there is a plan. We have a plan with a provision in the plan. And there is a person, you know, it's just very, it's very off-putting. I don't think the American people will tolerate that.
Since you're in Washington, we have to ask you political questions. Can a candidate for president of the United States be funny and presidential at the same time?
Well, Dole didn't make it, and Stevenson didn't make it. And they had genuine humor. I mean, they had humor that came from inside. John Kennedy was as close as we got to it, to the perfect match of a little bit of wit and style and the great power of the White House. I don't know. I think they're all afraid of that. Bob Orban would know a little more about that, having written things for many presidents and politicians and aspiring presidents and politicians. I think they're funny enough, they don't need to add anything to it.
You've often talked hilariously about your Catholic education. On a more serious note, have you found any lasting value from attending Catholic schools?
Well, I attended a rather odd school. In the 1940s, I attended a school that's still in existence, Corpus Christi in New York City, and it was not a typical Catholic grammar school education. It was not a typical experience. For one thing, we had boys and girls together. We did not wear uniforms. The desks were all movable, and there were no report cards. There were no grades or report cards of any kind. We were right across the street from Teachers College in Columbia University, where John Dewey had promulgated most of his theory. And our pastor was a fan of the John Dewey approach to education and insisted that the nuns who taught us have master's degrees from secular institutions. He didn't want them from Catholic universities. He wanted the ones who had been out, seemingly at least in the world, for a while. And they were wonderful. There was no corporal punishment. And it was a garden. It was a place that let me flower. I don't know what I might have done or how I might have been had I had that rigid discipline. And in fact, when I got to high school, I was faced with the Irish Christian Brothers after leaving these wonderful, gentle Dominican nuns to the Irish Christian Brothers. And they were, I think, instrumental in my leaving school. I quit school after middle of ninth grade. So I think the brothers and the stern discipline are what helped abort my formal education.
Do you have any good behind-the-scenes stories about filming the TV series That Girl with Marlo Thomas?
That was when I found out I couldn't act. It was amazing to me. I just thought it was a birthright. I thought, well, I do that's what I do. I'm this now, and I'll just be that. I'll just go and be that. And I found all these extra things you had to do. I had memorized my lines. But now they're saying things to me like, as you come down the stairs, remember the divorce is in progress. And the phone rings. It might be the lawyer. It might be your wife. Keep that in mind. And by the way, stay to the left side of the staircase. And don't stand in her light when you get to the bottom. And try taking some of those lines a little bit slower. And if you could, take your hand out of your pocket and then put it back in there. And turn once. It was just, you know, I was a nervous wreck. I just, I did poorly, I deserved to, and it's one of the things that propelled me. Nothing behind the scenes that I can recall. I'm lucky to recall it at all.
Speaking about that era, what do you regret most about the 60s?
Well, the 60s are somewhat misnamed because it lasted well into the early 70s and didn't really get going till the middle of the 60s, but what do I regret most about the 60s? Not very much, I must tell you. I've had a lucky life. And I've had a very good life in terms of being able to live out my dream, as my childhood dream. And the 60s were just one more good decade for me. I've had a lot of good decades, and that was the one where I went through my own transformation. I was what I think of as a mainstream comedian for about 5 years with some fair success on variety shows and first line nightclubs. And I found out I wasn't really content. I was kind of entertaining people who didn't care, and I had a lot of other things I wanted to say. So it was the 60s that created that that turnaround for me. It was because there was a counterculture that I said, well, there's another audience. There are people who are a bit rebellious, as I feel I am, and maybe I should be entertaining them. That's what changed my life. That's when the Four Gold Records happened, and that's when everything took off. So very little negative I can say about the 60s.
Mr. Carlin, we have a certificate of appreciation here for you, suitable for framing.
Thank you very much.
And
right next to the National Rifle Association one.
The much coveted National Press Club mug.
This will get a lot of use.
Okay. And for our final question, where's Christian? She needs to be ready for this. Was yesterday your birthday?
Yes.
Okay. You want to tell us how old you were?
62.
Yeah. We have a surprise for you.
You're getting a cake.
Would you all join me in singing happy birthday to George Carlin? Are you ready for this? Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear George. Happy birthday to you.
Thank you very much.
George, thank you for coming here today. I would also like to thank National Press Club staff members Leanne Boren, Pat Nelson, Melanie Abdo-Dermont, and Howard Rothman for organizing today's lunch. Also, thanks to the National Press Club Library for their research. We're adjourned. Thank you.